Kia ora he uri tēnei o Te Atiawa me Taranaki, ko Alistair Puna Samuvola Hau. I teach at the Faculty of Māori and Indigenous Studies at the University of Waikato, and one of the great joys of the last 3 years of my life has been a Marsden-funded project called Writing the New World, Indigenous Texts 1900 to 1975. The project spends time going all around the region, 1900 to 1975, a period that we actually don't know that much about. We spend a lot of time talking about kind of first adventures and connections with Europeans coming into the region, and we talk about more recent things, but particularly in the area of writing and literary studies, which is my own background, it's kind of like what really happened between, you know, the end of the kind of contact colonial period and Albert Went. Like, what happened in that time in between? Writing the New World has brought together 16 different Indigenous researchers from all around the region with really different backgrounds and different perspectives and different skills. And the podcast is intended to feature their views, their ideas, their experiences, so that you also can have an opportunity to connect with this writing, but also with the region that it comes from. The whole concept of the podcast is so much that happens at universities, really are things that people beyond the university might be interested in hearing about. We're interested in celebrating the writing from this time period, but also celebrating the work of the amazing researchers that have worked on the project. And so we are hopeful that members of their communities and the members of the communities that produce this writing in the first place would find these podcasts to be interesting, and maybe would have them ask some questions and feel interested in knowing a bit more about the writing of their own communities. In order to contribute to the New Zealand Pacific and Māori Language Weeks, in 2020, a special issue of the podcast is being launched with each of those language weeks, featuring people from those language communities speaking about their research in that language.
Aloha and ka ona. Today's podcast features Te Ma'onuku Uva. He will be talking about his multilingual research journey with Hawaiian language text, a journey that spans oceans of time, generations and language. It is titled Navigating Hawaiian Language Nupepa. Enjoy.
Mai kupi ina kala i hae hae ai ka mole ohu le hua i kawai, aloha nui kaku. O te mau o nuku hiva te iki te kahi oho ko u inoa. O ka manao o te mau o nuku hiva, o ia hoi ka malu o nuku hiva. Ka malu o ia hoi kia la malu e noho ana ma nā kumula au, ma nā ao, o nā mokupuni, nāna no hoi e ho'omalu ai i ka po'e, nā holoholona, nā ano mea ola like ole o ka moku. O nuku hiva, o iho i ke aina kumu, ke aina hanao o ku umakua hine o nuku hiva ho'e. Nō leila, o ia ko'u inoa o te ma'u o nuku hiva, ae e ieno vau ma ke kula nui o Waikato i ke ia vā e hana ni i ka uhana noi i. No Hawaii mai au, no ka mokupuni o Ke Awe, ka moku o Puna, o Tames ko umakua kāne, o Teta ko umakua hine, no nuu hiva oia. Ae, mamake wale no vau e ka o mai kai i keia, i ka poe e ho'olohe ana i keia, no ka ho'olohe ana i ka olelo Hawaii, e olelo i ana ma keia aina o Aotearoa. Mamake wau e olelo e ho'omau i ka hana mai kai, ma ka ho'ola olelo Hawaii, ka ho'ola mo'omeheu, ka ho'ola i nga ano like ole, o ka ho'ola o iwi ana. Ae, a oia, aloha. Aloha mai kako. My name is Te Ma'u o Nuku Hiva, te iki te kahi oho Wolf. I come from the island of Hawaii, aka the Big Island, from the Moku, or the district of Puna. Yeah, And now I'm here in Aotearoa, and I'm currently doing a Master's of Māori and Pacific Development. A little something about me is that my mother, she's from the island of Nukuhiwa in the Marquesas. Yes. My father, he's from Hawaii. He was raised in Hawaii, but actually born in South America, in Suriname.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And okay. He comes from a Dutch-American family.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
As a continued part of his introduction, Te Mau explains the meaning behind his name, his multi-Pacific heritage, his upbringing, the regular visits from Hawaii to Nukuhiwa, and the special people and places that have inspired his research journey.
My grandfather was a really interesting and funny person. He grew up in Nukuhiwa for his whole life in the valley of Taipiwai, and he was a farmer. His main job was producing copra.
Okay.
So cracking coconuts and harvesting coconuts for money. So right now on my family's land, the plantations that he planted of coconut trees still exist today.
Okay.
And so what a lot of he was doing at that time has translated to us nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of breadfruit trees, mango trees, banana trees, coconut trees on our land that we eat from that he had planted.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so my grandfather, he was a very skilled orator as well.
Mm.
And so that really helped with my interest in learning the language, because
yes.
The way he could say things and the way his voice rose and his cheekiness and how he talked, you know, it was so interesting to me.
Mm.
He never really had a formal education. His education was with his grandparents and with his parents.
Mm-hmm.
And from that came a lot of cultural knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So my grandfather, and he was one of the few people that remembered the old legends,
yes.
that were passed down orally.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, and these legends have never been recorded before.
Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
there's no literature out there you can Google or, you know, research for.
Mm.
They were in his brain.
Mm.
And so luckily I had some family members who were interested enough to record his voice,
okay.
so that these legends lived on. And
okay.
Yeah.
Is he still alive now?
He passed away a few years ago in 2015.
Okay.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So were you fortunate, were you privileged to have heard some of that knowledge being passed down when you were
yes.
living with them?
Yeah, yeah. A lot of stories about the old chiefs in our valley, the old kaitiaki, the old guardians of our valley,
yeah.
and a lot of family history too.
Okay.
Yeah, so before he passed away, he gave me he taught me about the meaning of my name.
Okay, oh lovely.
Yeah, Te Mau'ua Nukuhiwa. So when I was born, my mom gave birth to me, my grandfather said, if this baby has blonde hair, you can give the dad, the dad has the responsibility to name it, but if the baby has black hair, I'll name the baby.
Nice.
And so he said, okay, I came out of black hair, and he called me Te Mau'ua Nukuhiwa after his great-great-grandfather, or his great-grandfather.
All right.
And funny enough, 3 months later, I had blonde hair.
Yeah.
Like, how babies, you know, they change all the time.
Yes, just
yes.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so it was kind of funny. But he gave me this name, Te Mau'ua Nukuhiwa, which was a name of one of the first half-Chinese, half-Marquesan ancestors in our family lineage who had a store in the other valley, Hatiheu.
Mm.
And he was he gave me the story that this name, Te Mau'ua Nukuhiwa, the meaning of it, he broke it down for me. He said, Te Mau means the shade or the calming, and O Nukuhiwa is of the island of Nukuhiwa.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so okay. He said that Te Mau Nukuhiwa represents all the shades that are in the trees,
okay.
the shades that you find in the cloud,
nice.
The shade that protects the animals
nice.
From the hot sun in Nukuhiwa,
yes.
because it's a tropical island. It's really important, and a lot of the time people spend are in the shade.
Yes.
And so it's kind of metaphorically talking about this peace coming over the island of Nukuhiwa.
Wow.
So I graduated from the University of Hawaii at Hilo with a Bachelor's of Arts in Hawaiian Studies and Marine Science with a minor in Math. And my main research in the Hawaiian Studies Department, a lot of it was looking at the archives of newspapers or nupepa in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it looked at the different legends that were told through Nupepa. So in one of our classes, we followed one of the publications, the installments of different legends. And in another one, for one of my research projects, I looked at the Hawaiian missionaries who wrote letters that were published in the newspapers about their travels in the Marquesas Islands as missionaries. Yes, looking at the thing about the Marquesas Islands as a whole is that there, the people didn't really have an opportunity to write a lot. There is not really much of a literary history written by people from the Marquesas. You know, so a lot of the what we know about those times and what was happening comes from these letters from missionaries and the people that were traders stopping in, the whalers, all of those people. So what was real interesting about the perspectives of these Hawaiian writers that went over there, these Hawaiian missionaries, is that one, they could spell really, really good the names of Nuku'iwa, whereas English people, you get all these wacky, funny, weird names, and you're like, oh, I don't know who that chief's name actually was. You have to kind of guess. So they tell a lot about the history going on, and they tell it accurately.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, what's going on in Nuku'iwa. And there's actually a lot of information about the culture of different islands in the Marquesas that has been written by these missionaries at that time that it has not been written by anyone else.
Oh, wow.
Similar to the Hawaiian missionary experience in Nuku'iwa, and especially inspired by the strong example set by his grandfather, Te Mau discusses how his grounding in both Hawaii language, Oleleo Hawaii, and Eo Inanna allowed him to develop the necessary critical linguistic skills to analyze these very important surviving historical texts. Here he is explaining the similarities between Hawaiian language and Eo Inanna Marquesan.
Yes, they're actually really, really similar languages.
Okay.
And I I know this firsthand because I was born and raised in Puna on Hawaii Island, and I went to a Hawaiian immersion school.
Okay.
So I learned Hawaiian language and English first.
Okay.
It wasn't until about I was 11 or 12 years old that my parents started to reconnect with Nuku'iwa.
Okay.
And we went back, we started to go back during the summer breaks, which is between June through August in the Northern Hemisphere. So it's been a few months at a time in Nuku'iwa, and the people and the language still lives very alive.
Okay.
It's very alive over there. So about 10 years ago, and it still lives today.
Okay.
Yeah, it still lives within a lot of the elders and the and the older people. Actually, my grandfather, he's the one we would always stay with, and we stayed with him in the valley of Taipiwai on Nuku'iwa Island. And he actually couldn't speak French. The only languages he could speak was Eo Inanna, which is the Marquesan language, or Reo Ma'ohi, which is the Tahitian language.
Oh, wow.
And he just picked that up because of the Tahitians that visit commonly to Nuku'iwa, or also just watching the news in Tahitian because it comes on every night.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So since he couldn't speak French or English, the only way I could communicate with him was through Hawaiian.
Wow.
Yeah, so I would speak Hawaiian to him, and sometimes he'd speak Eo Inanna back to me.
Okay.
And eventually, just being surrounded by the language and learning from him, I picked up on the language of the Marquesan language.
Wow, what a real privilege. It's an incredible opportunity to be able to do that.
It was really important for me to learn my own language before even learning French.
Yes.
Yeah, and a lot of people were asking, why don't you learn French first?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's not my language. I don't want to learn that language. I want to learn this language first. And it was way easier to catch up on because things are so similar. Like, for example, in Hawaii, we say aloha for hello.
Yeah.
In the Marquesas, we say ka'oha.
Ah,
ka'oha for hello. And in Hawaii, it also means I love you or love.
Yes.
And it also means goodbye. And o'i kuru nukuhiva. It's the same three meanings.
Yes.
Once you see those linguistic little differences, like the L turns into a R or a glottal stop or whatever, then,
really easy. It's a nice transition for you and your family, and particularly for you across the generations, to be able to navigate all those different histories and different languages.
Yeah, yeah.
Really fascinating.
It is. So, it was a research project for my Hawaiian Studies seminar.
Okay.
Yeah, and so we had to write at least a 20-page research paper on some sort of aspect of Hawaiian culture or something related to Hawaiian studies. And for me, I wanted to rediscover more about myself as an Inanna or a Makesan person. And I was really interested in looking at these Hawaiian language texts written by these missionaries. Because, not everyone can actually translate it or even look at the texts with a Hawaiian language and Makesan language background. Because they actually do use some Makesan language words inside of it and concepts.
That's what one of the other key points I wanted to pick up on was how important it is for Indigenous people to do Indigenous research. Because, as you were saying, you bring the language skills into it. You bring the cultural lenses on top of it. No one else could do so.
After discussing his previous research experience with Hawaiian language texts, Te Mau outlines his research objective for the Writing the New World project, his findings and inspirations for his current master's study.
For this project, I was given the task to do a critical overview of the periodicals through the time frame we're looking at, 1900 to 1975, specifically focusing on the Hawaiian language newspapers that were printed around that time. So I was like, oh, I get to read more Hawaiian language newspapers? Nice. Like, yes, like, I want to do that project. I want to read some more olelo. So yeah, that was my project, and I think it kind of stems back to that idea that, Indigenous people should be writing and looking at our own literature and our histories, because what I found through doing it was that I learned a lot more about what was happening around that time, the injustices that were going on that time, and just the strength and the sovereignty and the patriotism showed by Hawaiians in the early 1900s. Because it was such an important and critical time in Hawaiian history. So a lot of what I had to do for that research, for looking at the newspapers and what's being written about at this time period, is what specifically was going on. And so starting in the 1900s, that was right after the Hawaiian kingdom overthrow.
Yes.
1893, the kingdom is overturned. 1898, it gets annexed. And right at 1900, it becomes a territory of America. So one thing that I discovered during my research is that from 1900 and a little bit earlier and a little bit afterwards, there's all these newspapers being printed in Hawaii of resistance, of patriotism, trying to get the crown and the power of the people back into the people's hands.
So these papers themselves, do you want to give us an overview of the types of newspaper we're coming through? Were they primarily government papers? Were they grassroots newspapers?
So mainly, most of the newspapers that were being produced at this time, they were independent, kind of grassroots newspapers. They were patriotic newspapers. So one of the newspapers that I followed closely was a newspaper called Ke Aloha Aina. And Ke Aloha Aina means the love of the land, or it could be translated to as patriotism or the patriots. So that newspaper was started in 1896 by Joseph Nawahi. He's actually the namesake or the person my old immersion school was named after. So I had that other connection that made me even more interested in reading what he was writing about and the legacy that this newspaper carried. And so a lot of what that newspaper writes about are the injustices happening to Hawaiians at that time and being very critical about what the American government is doing in Hawaii at that time. And one of the things that I really gravitated to during the history of Hawaii around that period was in the 1920s, there was this act called the Hawaiian Homes Commissions Act. And this was the act that was essentially done because Hawaiians were, they were seeing that Hawaiians were being pushed aside and not really taken care for. So the act gave leases of crown land for very cheap to Hawaiians so that they could have a place to live. But it was also the start of the blood quantum in Hawaii.
Yes,
it was where this term of Native Hawaiian came about and where you have to have 50% of blood quantum to be qualified for this program and everything. And so I looked at Ke Aloha Aina and the articles that they were writing about this act at the time. Mm. And what were they saying, you know? Like, were they okay with this blood quantum? Mm. What did they think about that? What did they think about this for the future of Hawaii?
Yes, of course. Mm. So do you think people in the 1920s anticipated the complications and the complexities of blood quantum then?
I didn't really get that. Yeah, mm-hmm. I don't think they really were focused too much on that, how it marginalized people, how they didn't really see that at the time. What they were focused on was the policy itself,
yes. Okay.
And what was being what was happening. So a lot of the articles that I read were looking at the types of lands that Hawaiians could get at that time.
Okay. Okay.
And there was a lot of complaints about how a lot of the lands that were being parceled out for Hawaiian homes were not the best lands to be for Hawaiians to be living on. Mm-hmm. They weren't lands that were fertile, mm-hmm. that people could live off the land and plant and support mm-hmm. their families. Mm-hmm. Instead, they were giving those good lands mm-hmm. to sugarcane farmers mm-hmm. and businessmen.
Yes, very similar parallels to the Waikatoa land wars and all sorts of legislation that was passed in multiple communities in the Pacific
yeah.
in terms of land confiscation and theft,
yes.
I suppose.
Really
interesting in terms of those papers and what people were talking about then and points of resistance. Because what Indigenous archives and colonial archives do is they encapsulate all these points of tensions that we need to, as scholars, unpack. You know, so it's reading through and past and listening to what's not being said and hidden meanings in terms of text. So
yes.
So this is why I think it's really awesome in terms of Indigenous people picking up on this, because no one else can understand the subtleties of that. And one word in particular could mean multiple meanings.
Yes.
How important is it for you to be responsible and accountable? Tell us more about that, your community.
Yeah, I think it's important because Pacific cultures and Indigenous cultures in general are very reciprocal.
Mm-hmm.
So being accountable to representing these stories correctly
mm-hmm.
and representing it for our community
mm-hmm.
Is something, as a part of that reciprocity, of
mm-hmm.
giving back to what our ancestors have left to us.
Mm-hmm.
And in context of the Hawaiian archives, they left us a lot to unpack.
Mm-hmm.
There's just so many different newspapers and stories and there's so much to unpack from it. And I think it's important that Indigenous researchers take on that accountability.
Yeah, absolutely. And completely agree.
It was really an interesting project to be a part of because of the language aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So all the documents that I looked at were in Hawaiian language.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that the more I did research, the better that my language was developing as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something that I really got out of it. And even more of a deeper and a deeper understanding of the language
mm-hmm.
and a deeper appreciation
mm-hmm.
of the poetry that is Hawaiian language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I learned a lot of new words and a lot of political words
yes.
that I wasn't expecting to learn through these, like the different rankings that Hawaiian people called the different, you know?
Yeah, stratified.
Stratified, yeah, yeah.
Types of references.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And like how we were saying there's so many meanings to one word, you know? I'd have to look up on the dictionary a lot of times what this word meant, because I thought it meant this one, but it means this and this and this too. I'm like, wow. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And someone outside the language would never understand those.
Yeah.
Those complexities. I know, is it kaona?
Kaona, yes.
Kaona, the meaning kaona is hidden meaning.
Hidden meanings, exactly.
And it's quite powerful, like we were talking earlier about how crucial it is for those textual encounters and human encounters to be understood properly and not just be taken for granted, like you were saying.
Yeah, so for my current research, I'm doing it on the fishing methods and traditional knowledge in Nuku'iwa Island.
Nice.
And for this research, I went back to Nuku'iwa and I went back to my local community of Taipiwai and a few other communities around the island, and I conducted some oral elder interviews.
Nice.
In the native language.
Wow.
Yeah, and for me, a lot of my time spent in Nuku'iwa as a young kid was spent fishing.
Yes.
So I enjoyed it so much, and I really wanted to learn more about the type of fishing that was done in Nukuhiva, mm-hmm. and how important that was mm-hmm. to our people.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you go to Nukuhiva, fish are eaten almost every day.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a staple.
It's a staple, mm-hmm. yeah. A lot of people are still reliant on the resources in Nukuhiva,
okay.
as opposed to a lot of stuff that's shipped in.
Okay.
So I think it was
pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people are still hunters, are fishermen, are agriculturalists.
Okay.
So
still subsistence.
Yeah,
type of
still a lot of subsistence. Okay. Yeah, maybe you get a little bit of rice and bread on the side, but for most of our meals we eat bananas,
yeah.
we eat fish, yeah. we eat breadfruit.
Yes. Okay. Mm. So still practicing traditional diets.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is pretty phenomenal.
Yeah.
So, that's incredible.
Yeah. And so I was really interested in learning more about this subsistence that was going on in the time of my grandfather.
Mm.
I think it's kind of in terms of revitalizing and recontextualizing a lot of the fishing practices of old into nowadays.
Okay, nice.
And that can eventually lead into kind of having better decisions on our resource management in the future.
Okay.
So using the old knowledge of fishing and just everything that revolves around it that the ancients used. And what I found out in my research is that a lot of that knowledge is still used today.
Nice.
And it is being recontextualized.
Okay.
Yeah, so... For one example is that I've read in old texts and from old accounts that there used to be this fishing method to catch parrotfish with a net, and you would use a decoy parrotfish to catch it. And there's this understanding that you have to know that parrotfish, male parrotfish, are very territorial.
Mm.
So when you have a male parrotfish in another one's territory, the other one will just come and attack it viciously. Yeah, it'll come, and it'll come right into the net, and that's what the ancestors used to do.
Okay.
Nowadays, we have spear guns, and so that technique is still used by the younger generation, but with new technologies.
Mm.
So it's being reintegrated.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and still being held on to and still relevant today. Yes,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And with the intersection of technology as well, I mean, it's just an added benefit to even utilize that indigenous knowledge
in terms of
modern technology.
Yeah.
Which is less intensive and less, and more environmentally responsible.
Yeah, more environmentally responsible.
Yeah.
And I'd say, especially too, what I wanted to... The perspectives of the elders was what was real important was that during their time until now, there was a big shift from subsistence economies into the introduction of money.
Mm.
So they would give me a lot of stories of how back in their day, fish was never bought.
Mm.
You could never buy a fish. It was always if somebody went fishing and they caught a lot of fish, the whole village would be fed.
Yes.
You know, it would be distributed like that. So I was real interested to see how these resources were distributed before money came along.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, speaking as a fisherman's daughter, very much the same. Dad would go fishing with his net and we would just hope that a fish would eventually make it home.
Yes, yeah.
Because that's who's walking around the village, exactly. Because, oh yes, no, this is for the old man or this is for the old lady.
Yeah.
Make sure you cook it properly. And
Yeah,
very much similar cultural practices.
Mm.
And I think a lot of the discussions previously with the other groups was this commodification of our resources in terms of particular practices that had a lot of meaning that kept a lot of the ecology in terms of social structures and prestige with different roles intact.
Yeah.
We're disrupted, heavily disrupted by it.
With those commercial issues, I think kind of comes the commercial mentality for a lot of the fishermen.
Yes.
So a lot of fishermen nowadays, they want to make as much money as possible.
Yeah.
And sometimes it comes at the expense of over-exploiting some of the resources.
Yeah.
So for one of the big things in Nukuhiva and across the Marquesas nowadays is lobster.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's lobster.
Big market for it.
Big market for it, yeah. Uh-huh. So only recently throughout the 70s and the 80s, around that time, the Marquesas got refrigeration and also strong enough lighting to go night diving in the Marquesas.
Okay. Right.
So lobster is heavily harvested nowadays and exported to Tahiti.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of like there was kind of a shift in the mentality of seeing this resource as our own, and we have to take care of it for our own generations, towards wanting to have more money and provide more money for each family. Yes. Yeah.
With future Indigenous researchers in mind, Te Mao was asked to reflect on his recent research journey, on what he would have told his younger self.
I would probably tell myself, be patient. You don't need to know everything right now, and you don't have to be the know-it-all. You don't have to know everything in order to be a researcher, you know? And I'd say, write from the heart and follow your heart, or your na'au, as we say in Hawaii, your guts in your writing. Let that kind of help you lead with the research, because when that leads the way, the research becomes way more meaningful, and way more powerful to you and the communities that we're giving back to.
Continuing with the time travel theme, Te Mao was asked what legacy he'd like to leave behind for the future generations, and if given the chance, what would he like to say to his 60-year-old self?
That I hope that Nukuhiva's and that the younger generations have been inspired to look to their own culture and to kind of decolonize the views that are going on and the educational system that's going on in Nukuhiva right now. I want to tell myself that, you know, I hope you succeeded in revitalizing the language and getting the language back up to where it used to be, and continuing it on with the new generation. And that I hope our traditions never die, and I hope we look back to our ancestors' work and revitalize it and continue it, because we're in a time where it's real pivotal in changing and either leaving it behind or taking it with us. So yeah, I hope you took it with us.
That's a powerful message.
I currently co-host a Hawaiian language podcast called Lohe Ia, which means to be heard.
Okay.
Or it can also mean listen up.
Nice.
Yeah, like a command. Hey, Hawaiian talk to you. Listen up. That's something to say.
Yeah,
We do a casual podcast. We try to find time in our own free times to come together and converse about all different sorts of topics relating to Hawaii and across the Pacific, all done in Hawaiian language.
Oh.
Yeah, so I do it with my other two friends who graduated from the Hawaiian Language College back at UHilo, and you can find us on Spotify or SoundCloud if you're interested, or follow us on Instagram, where we do little snippets of interesting conversations that we've had, and we'll even start providing a little bit of translation so we can reach a broader audience.
Nice. Awesome, Malo.